So I wrote an article about 2 years ago, came out about a year ago, that I was trying to articulate an orientation that has some spiritual elements that I just felt hadn't been articulated before. I don't know if that's true or not, but I sat down and I wrote it, and you know, when you write something, it's a much more different process. You can take your time, you can be contemplative, you can change words. And so, you know, it's a very solitary thing, and I was able to get it on paper, and it got published in this magazine. So when I was asked to speak about it, I felt a little daunted because I didn't know how to say it other than what I wrote, but I didn't want to stand here and read to you. So I'm going to try to articulate the main points, but I'm going to do it a little differently than I did in my article, but I may refer to it, so forgive me if I do read it to you just a little bit. So I'll start with three stories, if you don't mind, has to be three. I couldn't. And stories just seem a better way to go. So indulge me, and then we'll get back to awism. Because really, that's, I guess, the theme. Awe-ism as an A-W-E. And that was the orientation I was trying to proclaim. So the first, they're all personal about my life. It's where I got my awe. In 2005-2006, I was living with my wife and two kids in Denmark. And I don't know why, but I love Scandinavia. It's an irrational draw to spiritual draw, if you will, one for which I can't really explain. Even when I was there, people would say, why would you come here? And I just love it here. And so we were living in Aarhus, which is the second largest city in Denmark. It's on the Jutland Peninsula, which sticks out north of Germany into the ocean, the Kattegat Sea and the Skagerrak Sea. And I was working at the university. I was doing research for a book. Had my wife and two daughters, and my wife was pregnant at the time, so we actually had a baby born in Denmark, which was quite a joy. So we had, my one daughter was in second grade, my other daughter was in the preschool, and I would go to the university every day, my wife was writing something every day, but we found this one little cafe in Aarhus, and Scandinavians don't eat out for breakfast, it's unheard of, it doesn't happen, but we found one cafe that was open in this city that catered, I guess, to the three international people that happened to be looking for a place to eat in the morning, and it was a wonderful little place, and it was so great, because not only was the food amazing, and the coffee amazing, and the pastries amazing, but no one was ever there, because Danes don't eat out for breakfast, so we always had the place to ourselves, and we had great furniture, very sleek design, the whole Scandinavian thing. So one morning, so me and my wife found, hey, every Friday morning, let's go have breakfast at this place, and that will be our time together without the kids, and just to enjoy and relax. So one particular Friday morning, in the middle of winter, something happened. I'm not a meteorologist. I'm not a weather person, so maybe someone in the audience can explain it. I heard some theories. But we woke up, it was in winter, and the entire world was encoded in a thin layer of ice. Everything. All the bushes, every leaf, every lamppost, every bicycle parked in the street, every item in the world was covered in a thin layer of glassy ice. And it wasn't frost. It was translucent. So it wasn't white. It was glass-like. And we walked from our apartment to downtown Aarhus in an absolute state of marvel. It was like the entire world was encased in this magical glassy frost. So we were cold, but you didn't feel the cold. We were just in amazement. And my wife was pregnant, and we were walking very gingerly because the Danes that are quite rational, so they get the ice off the sidewalks and the bike paths very quickly. In fact, the bike paths get first priority in Denmark. They throw salt on to get the bikers on their way, and then come the pedestrians, and then finally the cars get their due. And we just couldn't say much. We just kept stopping and looking at a rose petal, looking at a twig covered in this pure glass. We took some pictures, but mostly it was just a silent walk, and we got to our cafe and felt an amazing sense of wonder and amazement and beauty, and it was wonderful, and we just cherished that morning. We always talk about it, and we always remember it. Boom, story number one. like I said, very personal, but I'll come back to it and refer to it. Story number two, you know, another personal deal I just got to share. I just turned 40 on Friday. I don't know if that's good news or bad news for the candle, but thank you. So I was a teenager in the 80s, and for some reason, I listened to KRF 101. I don't know. All my friends were listening to new wave music or punk music or pop music, and I kept listening to KRF 101, and I really liked 60s music. So I was listening to the Love and Spoonful all the time, and of course the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel and the Doors and all that stuff. And then one day, this song came on, and I happened to be recording off the radio, and it was in a song I'd never heard by a band called Love, which I had never heard of. Very obscure band. I loved the song. And I just called the station. I said, "What is this song?" And they said, "Well, it's a song by a band called Love." And I went to the record store and I got this album. It came out in 1968 on the Elektra label. No one had ever heard of this band. I never met anybody who heard of this band. They never had a number one hit, but, you know, I love this record. And the fun thing about records before CDs came out was like you could really listen to one side for a long time. And then you finally took that leap to the other side for a long time. Then you had to decide which side was better or whatnot. So this was my favorite band, but it was very solitary love because none of my friends listened to 60s music. But even people, 20 years older than me, if I mentioned 60s music, if I said Love, they just kind of scratched their head. They were an L.A. band, and their main singer-songwriter was a guy named Arthur Lee. And Arthur Lee had a very tough life. He never had his hit record. He lived rough, and I think he battled alcohol, battled drugs. He found Jesus, the whole thing. And then he got busted on a third strike where some fan came to his apartment in Northridge and I guess shot off a gun into the air, and he got charged with discharging a firearm in public even though he hadn't done it. They busted him, and he had two earlier strikes from the 70s involving drugs. So he was put away for 25 years to life. And I read about this in the LA Weekly, I think. Oh, poor old Arthur Lee. And I actually wrote him a letter in prison. I think, and he wrote me back. It was really amazing. But the point is, one day, about, when was this? 7, 8 years ago, the phone rings on a Thursday afternoon, and it's a mother of a friend of mine. She says, "Phil, Arthur Lee just got out of prison. They found prosecutorial misconduct, and they let him out, and he's playing tonight at the Knitting Factory in Hollywood." And I couldn't believe it. He had served about 8 or 9 years of his sentence, maybe 12. And I said to my wife, "Please, dear, may I leave you with the kids tonight and drive into Hollywood?" And it was very spur of the moment. And I got in my car. I couldn't find anybody who was willing to go with me. And I drove to the Knitting Factory on a Thursday, sat through traffic. I pulled up. I didn't have a ticket. It was sold out. I walked up to the box office. I said, "Can I get in?" They said, "Yeah, here's a ticket." I got in. The next thing I knew, I was standing this far, and Arthur Lee came out and played every song I had ever loved, and it was the most amazing, mind-blowing experience. I was floating the entire time, and I floated home. I got back to Claremont at 1 in the morning, and it was an absolute high. Thank you for indulging me with that story. I promise it will have relevance. And finally, number three, I'll take you back to Scandinavia. I thought about this one this morning, and it really struck a chord. After our year in Denmark, we went up to spend 2 weeks in Norway. And if you've never been to Norway, it is the most stunningly beautiful place I've ever been. I can't think of any place more spiritual, more beautiful, more awe-inspiring than Norway. Wow. Unfortunately, it's the most expensive country in the world, and a cup of coffee will run you $12. But if you can get beyond that, we found a hostel that was relatively affordable, way up in the mountains, in between Oslo and Bergen, really up in the near Myrdal in the mountains. And we went up and we called them up. We said, "Do you have accommodations for a family?" They said, "Sure." Turned out we all slept in bunk beds that were quite small, and I'm only 5'8", and I still. But we managed. And so my son had been born; he was about 2 months old, and my two daughters. And we went up to Norway. We took the train up to this hostel, which was in the middle of the mountains. It was the end of June, so around this time, and nobody was there. It's basically a hostel that serves in the winter as a great hub for cross-country skiing, and no one really goes there in the summer. So we kind of had the place to ourselves, and there were waterfalls everywhere, rivers everywhere, and we had 11 days of sunshine and warmth, which in Norway is quite rare. about midweek, we said, well, let's take a hike. Let's just follow this river and see where it goes. And we got our daughters, and we had the baby in the baby dorm, my son. And we hiked, and we hiked up this valley, and it got hotter and hotter. And the trees started to sort of disappear. And suddenly we got crankier and crankier and hungrier because we had our food, but we didn't want to sit out in the open. It was quite sunny, and we were baking. And we thought, we can't go anymore. We have to turn back. My wife doesn't like to do that, though. She feels defeated. And we saw a woman on the side of the road. We said, is there any place we can stop, any shade? And she said, oh, if you just go around the bend, you'll see a little spot. We walked about 10 more minutes. We turned around the bend, and there was a crystal blue pool, natural pool, in rock. I mean, what do you call it? Not a human-made pool, but a nature-made pool. And the water was pure aqua blue, and it was literally at the base of a waterfall, and at the top of the waterfall was the snow, packs of snow still up in the mountains. So it was literally just the snow melting down the river into this pool of ice blue water, and there was a little bridge that we could sit under for the shade. Before we knew it, we got there, we stripped totally naked, put the baby down in the shade, and just jumped into this true, pure ice water, which we just drank as we were swimming in it. And we thought, maybe that's not safe, but I mean, you could see the water trickling right down from the ice. And it was so obviously invigorating, and we felt such joy. And then we ate our snacks and picnic and just stayed lounging at that pool all day. And of course, the days are very long in Scandinavia in the summertime. The sun won't set until around midnight where we were. So, you know, finally at around dinner time, we just headed back to the hostel. Okay. Got those two stories. Now comes the boring part of the lecture. I study religious people. That's what I do. I'm a sociologist, but my area is religion. And I've been doing that, I guess, well, I got my PhD in 98. So since 95, let's say, I've been officially studying religious people and religion. And so I often get asked the question, what are you? You know, people, as I'm interviewing people or talking to people, they want to know what I am. Where am I coming from? What are you? And I've always had a tough time with answering that question. Of course, I could say I'm culturally Jewish, which that goes without saying. Most people can tell that within the first 4 minutes, but or less. But, you know, they want to know something else. And, you know, they want to know what do I believe, basically. You know, if I'm with Christians, they want to know if I'm saved. Just, you know, what's the deal here? And I don't like to use the term atheist, although I am one and will check that box if asked, because I won't bore you with atheism here, but the problem is for me is it's an assertion of what I don't believe in. It's sort of a negation of other people's beliefs, and that feels like a real loss to me. If someone says to me, what are you? I don't want to simply say, well, I don't believe this. I mean, I could do that, but it's not, there's no crystal blue lake in that answer. It's just simply saying I don't believe something, which is fine. It's true. It's ideologically honest. But it doesn't capture any of the joy that I feel deeply. I mean, to say an atheist feels like a real missed opportunity. So sometimes I used to say agnostic when people ask me, well, what are you? Okay, I guess I could say an agnostic. But there's problems with that one, too. First of all, most people interpret it meaning as, I don't know if there's a God or not. Like a sort of indecision. Well, I've weighed all the evidence for God, and I've weighed all the evidence against, and boy, it's just right there at 50-50. I find that very odd. And more than that, it's not really a position. It's saying you're undecided. It's saying I can't make up my mind, which is great. But when someone says, what am I? I don't feel like saying, I don't know. I'm undecided. There's a deeper meaning to agnosticism, though, that I actually do think borders on the spiritual. And I think it's more in line with actually the word agnostic, which means without knowledge. That is the orientation that there are just some things we can't comprehend, that are beyond the limits of human understanding. Now, those might be, you know, the deep questions of, you know, time and space. Well, you know, where do they begin and end? I always, you know, my dad threw that one at me when I was about 9, and I've been scratching my head ever since. You know, and I still argue with my colleague, who's a mathematician who studies the universe, and I say, well, I can't conceive of, you know, the end of time or space. He goes, oh, sure you can. Just, you know, just think of the universe as a self-contained thing. And I said, well, okay, so what's outside of it? Well, nothing. You got me. That doesn't make sense. Well, it's like a balloon. I go, yeah, a balloon's got the rest of the room around it, the air around it. You know, what's outside of this universe? You know, how long is it going? So there's something there to being agnostic, which simply says, man, there's more than I can conceive of. But the thing is, when I start thinking that way, it tickles me. I have like an emotional reaction. When I start pondering these deep mysteries, it's not just cognitive. It's not just, you know, today must contemplate the beginning or end of time. Okay, done. Now it's time to work on a lecture on Du Bois or something. I mean, to me, there's an emotional reaction that borders on the spiritual. I mean, if you really try and contemplate how did this all, where did we all come from, how did it all begin, I think that is a very mystical endeavor. But it doesn't have to just come from, we'll get to that. So agnostic doesn't always work for me either. Number one, people think I say I'm indecisive, and I'm not. And number two, I don't believe there's a God, sorry. Okay. And number two, it's a little too heady. If I have to explain the philosophical elements of agnosticism, it suddenly might, you know, come on. That doesn't capture that concert with Arthur Lee from the front man of love at the Knitting Factory. Finally, I can always go on with secular humanist. Not the most pretty title. I don't know why. Oh, I dig it. I'm down with secular humanism. I love it. But to me, secular humanism is almost like a political, it's about what I advocate. You know, I'm for the separation of church and state. I'm for funding hospitals. I know that's crazy, but I'm for funding, you know, I'm for funding for the arts. I'm for human rights. I'm for civil rights. When I think of secular humanism, I think of all these things that I advocate as a citizen in America, trying to protect liberty and democracy from people who would put forth a theocracy or whatnot. Secular humanists fall flat when I think of that ice-coated morning in Denmark. When I was walking to that cafe, I didn't feel like a secular humanist. I felt a deep awe at existence, a deep wonder. And I won't, that's about as far as I can go. So I need a way to articulate that. And so when someone asked me what I am, I wanted to be able to say, I feel a deep awe at being. I feel a deep awe at nature. I feel a deep awe at human interactions. I feel a deep awe at picking up my kids from school. I feel a deep awe when I get a good Ben and Jerry's ice cream. I feel a deep awe at so, I didn't even know where to begin when I thought you wanted me to give this talk. I thought, how does someone articulate this? And it felt either terribly trite to say, oh, isn't it wonderful to be alive? I mean, it's almost such a cliche. And yet, that's what I feel, and I didn't feel like any of the labels articulated that. So I wanted to say to people, well, when they ask me what am I, I would say, I'm full of awe. I'm full of awe. So I'm an awist. And I decided that I would title my article Awism. And this is how I defined awism, if you will. Awism is the belief that existence is ultimately a beautiful mystery, that being alive is a wellspring of wonder, and that the deepest questions of life, death, time, and space are so powerful as to inspire deep feelings of joy, poignancy, and sublime awe. An awist is someone who admits that existing is wonderfully mysterious and that life is a profound experience. So for me, the three elements of awism would be, number one, a deep love of life. Now, we obviously don't feel that all the time. I had a big fight with my brother on my birthday. He stormed out of the house, so it goes. And, you know, I'm not saying I have to fix that one. So it's not that I walk around all day with my eyes brimming over with tears and my mouth wide open at the joy of every tree. But, you know, I feel those feelings every now and then. I don't know, suppose the way people talk to me about their feelings of God or their experiences of Jesus. I mean, I don't think they are constantly feeling the presence of Jesus, you know, as they ride every elevator. But every now and then they experience Jesus and it's so meaningful for them that they devote their life to that. So what I would say is I periodically have these wonderful feelings of awe. They come now and then, I don't know, once a month, once a year, hard to say, but they're so important that they seem to constitute the core of my being. and I wanted to articulate that. So there's a deep love of life, I think, that is part of autism, and joy and appreciation. And the second part is it's experiential. You feel it. It's not just an idea. It's not just a thought. It's something you feel in the core of your bones. And number three is that it's mysterious. And I think that is the crux, because I don't know where that feeling comes from, and I don't really care. You know what? A neuropsychologist could explain to me that it's just simple endorphins being triggered by a visual stimuli. That would be great. That's fine. Someone else could say to me, hey, those are moments you were tasked by God. Grand. Someone else might say, those were moments, you know, that you were hungry and you were hot and the water felt good and the food tasted good and your body was replenished. Fine. Is it physiological? Is it psychological? Did I have childhood memories that were triggered when I heard the music at the knitting factory? Whatever. It doesn't really matter to me. What matters is those feelings and how wonderful they are. And I do believe there is a spirituality there. But the difference is, I guess, is I don't attribute the source. To me, it makes it feel still somewhat of a secular orientation. I don't see these moments of awe as evidence for something. Ah, this proves that there must be a greater purpose in life. I don't know that. Ah, this proves that there's a God. I can't go there. All I can do is enjoy them, remember them, and derive a certain sense of joy and peace from them, which I think is at the heart of at least some people's spirituality, and it seems to be your spirituality too, if my brief experience here listening to the songs, I didn't know if you can pick those songs for my talk, but they certainly seem to go right in line with where I was coming from, and the words that you said in your affirmations, and so I'll just, I want to end with how I ended the article, and then I suppose we can open it up for questions. Or not, it's totally up to you. And this is how I ended my little essay on autism. Sven Erik Leidenman, a Swedish professor of intellectual history, has suggested that religion paints the world in bright colors, while atheism, being a negation of these bright colors, often appears to be tedious and monotonous. But Leidenman notes that this is problematic, for most non-religious people do indeed still paint and see the world in bright colors. Our lack of theism does not render this world any less wondrous, lush, mystifying, or amazing. Our free-thinking secular orientation does not mean that we live a cold, colorless existence devoid of aesthetic inspiration or existential feeling. Quite the contrary. One need not have Jesus or Muhammad or God to feel and experience awe. One just needs life. Thank you for listening to me.
Phil, I just loved everything you said.
Thank you.
But I think you avoided orders, and at least the word I would apply to your position, and that's humility.
Mm.
I think you're just positioned and humble.
Mm.
And I like that, because atheism and agnosticism tend to be, I don't know, sort of looks down on everyone else. And you're not doing that, and I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And I would agree that I think a lot of the popular atheists today that are writing the bestsellers and whatnot, there is that element there, and I think it's a shame. Someone sent me a book called Atheism Advanced, a man named David Eller, and on one page he says, you know, we must destroy every vestige of religion, every church, every belief, every story, and it made me shudder, and I put the book down, I wrote him an email, and I said, I stopped reading your book at page 92, thank you very much, what was your name, sir? I agree with what Jim said, but, you know, there is, unfortunately, what I would say is, when I was, the epiphany I had when I was sitting here, and this goes to both of you, I was sitting here, and I was listening to your choir, and there was that one song where the choir just sang, and one guy in the back here was getting really into it, Where is he? He just had his 23rd anniversary. Gary was getting really into it, so that made me get into it. And then the solo by the woman that teaches teenagers and little kids. Where are you? Is she not here? Oh, man, that just, my heart opened up, and I thought, oh, this is so much joy. And then for a minute, I thought, people that can't appreciate these moments, that's the problem, you know. And I thought maybe that's why atheists get this negative spin, because they seem to be looking down their noses at moments like that. But, of course, I am an atheist as well, but I'd like to think that I can still appreciate a good song and a nice congregation, and I would like to think that I still don't have this sense of, well, I understand everything. And the other thing about community, and I'll stop, I've talked enough, but, you know, there's a lot of people that say, well, everything will ultimately be explained scientifically, everything. And I just don't know if that's necessarily true, and I don't see the problem with saying, well, maybe there's just going to be some big unknowns out there. So, anyways, thank you for your comments.
At the risk of sounding like a proselytizer, I'll just venture to say you might be a Unitarian Universalist. It's interesting that you know you reject. Well, this isn't quite right. You know,
yeah.
On Facebook, they ask you religion. I thought, all right, well, I go to this church, I'll be a Unitarian Universalist, but then I'm all right. But I'm sort of in the I don't know camp, and I don't particularly care, although it's interesting. Really appreciate their that comes along. And actually, you know, that does kind of come about in this environment. It's trying to stop and focus and think about those things, and us, fellow people, and I'll take the weekend, kind of things a little bit better.
All right, thank you. I always thought that I was a UU person. Just from the people I know and the students that I've had. I had one amazing student that went on to be a minister, and everything she said about it made me feel like, you know. And I was so excited to come to this on today. And I have to say, I was a little disappointed when I heard you guys rented a synagogue. I was like, oh, no, back to synagogue. Not that I have anything against synagogue, but I thought, you know, finally, I guess you get, you know. I love synagogue. My kids go to Hebrew school, but I was so looking forward to it, because I've been to UU Church in Eugene, Oregon, which was just gorgeous, and it was so beautiful. I used to live in Oregon for 10 years, so I hope you guys, I'm happy to know you have this home here. It sounds wonderful, and I'd love to be somewhat affiliated somehow, and so thank you. I don't feel like you're proselytizing at all. I mean, that was the lowest key collection ceremony I have ever witnessed in my life.